company president or CEO or whoever. You speak for him and for everyone else who works in the organization. If I, as a police officer, were to badmouth people on the street and make them feel bad, they would go away not thinking about George Thompson, they rarely get my name or badge number, but rather the department. Research shows that if someone has a bad experience with a police officer, he will tell 27 to 28 people over the next 3 days. Imagine the statistics for bad experiences in stores or with companies. If someone in your organization treats people poorly, he lowers your credibility and the credibility of everyone you care about in the company, and he makes your job far more difficult. Effective professional language is that which contributes to voluntary compliance. Any language that makes compliance more difficult should be shunned. It may make you feel good to insult somebody, to tell them what you really think. But remember, if it makes you feel good, most of the time it won't work. Or as the samurai were fond of saying, if it makes you feel good, no good. Under the influence. Your customer or client or citizen is under various kinds of influence. He may be under the influence of anxiety, fear, misunderstanding, ignorance, rage, even liquor and drugs. You have to learn to read people carefully. The old samurai who said that if you don't know yourself, you lose 100% of the time, also said, if you know yourself but you do not know the opponent, you'll be lucky to win 50% of the time. If you know yourself and you know the opponent, you can win 100% of the time. That means one of the greatest communication skills is listening, really listening to people, to what they say and how they say it. And that leads me to the second great communication art. Chapter 14, The Second Great Communication Art, Translation. Once you have mastered the art of representation, translation becomes crucial. Translation is the ability to put what you say in the most proper, fitting, assertive, and powerful words possible. The goal is to put the precise meaning in your mind into your listener's mind. That means doing whatever is necessary to avoid the misunderstanding that comes with normal distractions and influences. In many ways, this is a simple process, communication boiled down to its four basic elements. 1. Content. You have to know what you're talking about. As a professional or a parent, you must decide precisely what it is you want and need to communicate. 2. Coding. Coding is merely putting your message into words. This involves thinking of those words as a code that reflects your meaning. Think, for example, how many ways there are to tell a man you cannot help him, or to tell a man to step out of his car. How many ways are there to tell your spouse you are sorry? Most not as effective as they could be. Words should be seen as a way of reflecting meaning, but not ego. You must separate your words, meaning, from yourself, ego. 3. Sending. Once you know your meaning and have chosen the words for it, it's time to transmit it, whether by phone or in person, using your voice and other nonverbals, facial expressions, body language, etc. 4. Decoding. Decoding is the responsibility of the hearer, but how well he decodes is in direct proportion to the effectiveness of the content, coding, and sending. Yours. His decoding is also affected by your demeanor and carriage, voice and body language, external noise, cars, planes, phones, people, etc., and his own internal noise, what I call brain damage, or any other influence he may be under. Most of us suffer from some level of brain damage. We don't like to be told what to do, perhaps, or we're tired or think we've done enough for one day, and we're ready to misunderstand what others are about to say. No wonder it's a nightmare to communicate. What looks like a simple process is actually difficult. We certainly will never get through to each other if we use the words that rise most naturally to our lips. We must remember if we do, we may wind up giving the greatest speech we'll ever live to regret. Of Rabbits and Green Cheese. Natural language is disastrous. That's what makes translation indispensable. I once heard a very interesting story that I believe proves my point. Neil Armstrong, the U.S. astronaut who in 1969 was the first man to walk on the moon, went on a world tour in 1972. In Japan, he was asked by a tiny grade school child what it was really like on the moon. When Armstrong heard the translation, he must have thought it a pretty simple question. He could have written a book on the subject. Rather than get into a long, complex answer for his young Japanese-speaking audience, he responded with a quick bit of humor. He said, "Well, I didn't find a man in the moon or any green cheese, that's for sure." The Japanese translator told the children that Mr. Armstrong had said, "Well, I didn't find any rabbits on the moon, that's for sure." Now, was that a good translation or a bad one? Believe it or not, it was excellent. Japanese culture contains no stories about a man in the moon or the moon being made of green cheese. In a full moon, they see a huge pregnant rabbit rather than a man. I've always seen her. Many Northeast Indians see the same thing, as do many other Asians. On the lower right side, at about 5 o'clock of the moon, they see a gray blotch they regard as a hutch of baby rabbits. They tell hundreds of stories to their children about the moon's mama rabbit and her babies. You'll notice that though the words were different, the meaning was the same. Armstrong was saying, in effect, that when he got to the moon, it wasn't at all what it appears from Earth. In our culture, that would mean no man and no green cheese. In Japanese culture, it means no mama rabbit or baby rabbits. Frankly, that kind of translating is what you do every day if you're communicating effectively. The police officer on the street has to figure out what kind of language will be most assertive and effective to calm a subject and redirect his behavior. What might work for the little old lady from Pasadena might not work for a young gentleman from Albuquerque. The language a cop would use for some country club yuppie would be totally different from what he might use for a gang member in Watts. He may be transmitting the same message, but you can be sure there will be entirely different words for widely differing people. My rule is, treat everyone the same, with respect and dignity, but don't talk to everyone the same way. You don't talk to each of your children the same way, do you? Since each responds differently, based on his or her makeup and character, you instinctively learn to communicate uniquely to each one. The great cops I've watched and worked with, the great salespeople I've watched and listened to, and the great teachers I've studied under, all have the same art. They may not think about it or dissect it as I do, but they will tell you that knowing one's audience and communicating in his language is one of the greatest skills there is. Some people are able to do this naturally, but still they have to figuratively stand in the other person's shoes. And that brings us back to empathy. If you're having trouble communicating with those from different walks of life, it may be because you're thinking about yourself instead of about them. If you allow your ego to get in the way, you will find yourself using your own language instead of the other person's. The great salesperson listens to people and interacts with them a while, then suddenly begins to use the right kinds of words, whether they be emotional or pictorial, to paint an effective picture. To effectively represent anyone or anything, you must get out of yourself and get into others. I've seen that taught nowhere else, yet it is a great fundamental skill. Get rid of your ego, put yourself into your job, and take pride that as a contact professional, you can walk the walk and talk the talk of your corporation or your business, and that you care enough about whom you're dealing with to use the right words for the right person at the right time. Before I get into the third great communication art, mediation, I want to cover some important information on the subject of listening to help put all three of the arts in perspective. My goal is to give you the skills, the tactics, and the philosophies you need to maximize your power in representation, translation, and mediation, so you can take pride in your artistry. An unnatural act. Listening is not a natural act. It is highly artificial and artistic. In fact, listening is not the opposite of talking, and if you think it is, you're as brain damaged as I used to be. In our culture, the opposite of talking is more like waiting to interrupt. Active listening is a highly complex skill that has four different steps: being open and unbiased, hearing literally, interpreting the data, and acting. Don't ever assume people are open and ready to listen. One thing that makes my course different from so many others is that I, having been on the streets, know that communication is not the listener's responsibility. It is the sender's. As a police officer, I had to ensure that I made people more cooperative and willing to be voluntarily compliant. High school teachers tell me, "I have a bad class. What can I do about that?" I say, "There is no such thing as a bad class, only bad teaching. Sorry, but the responsibility of getting through lies with the teacher." I almost always start out with difficult classes, because the attendees are usually mandated to be there. They don't think they want to be taught. They're already professionals. They're on the street, dealing in dangerous situations all day, and they're pretty sure that some PhD won't be able to tell them anything new, especially about talking their way out of situations, rather than taking charge physically. I have to perform in such a way as to get and hold their attention. Take the responsibility to be a good communicator. Get people to listen by the power and manner with which you send your message. When you're on the listening end, you may be open and unbiased and able to literally hear. But how do you interpret what you've heard so you can decide on a course of action? Start with one of my undeniable, inarguable street survival truths. People hardly ever say what they mean. If you react to what they say, you make a mistake. People under the influence of liquor, drugs, rage, fear, anxiety, ignorance, stupidity, or bias don't mean anything they say. If you begin to grasp this point, you can become a more effective communicator. Here are two examples. Deputy on the doorstep. I was going to teach verbal judo to a sheriff's department, so the night before the classes, I went out a ride-along with a young deputy. He answered a burglary call and knocked on the door. Before the deputy could answer the nature of the problem, he was hit with, "Where the heck have you people been? I called 3.5 hours ago, and you're just showing up now? This is a lot of crap. You know, I'm tired of you people. My taxes pay your salaries, and you're never here when I need you. I'm sick of this. Look at my house. It's stripped, everything gone. And what are you doing? Drinking coffee, having donuts, fooling around. You people write parking tickets when you should be enforcing the law." And that was just the beginning. The deputy, of course, had had a tough day, too. So he snapped off the words that came most naturally to his lips. "Hey, listen to me, sir. I don't have to listen to this. I'm not paid enough to take your verbal abuse. I'm here, so if you want some help, I'll give you some help. You want to stand there and rant and rave at me? I'm going to go back into service and let you handle your own problem." Then he turned to walk off the porch, and of course, the guy hit the roof. From what you've learned already, what should the deputy have said? All the words thrown at him were born of rage and frustration. The citizen, a victim, didn't mean a word of that diatribe. What he really meant were four different things. 1, I need some help. 2, can I get any of my stuff back? 3, how can I keep this from happening again? It's a jungle out there. 4, what do I do with the feeling of having just been raped? If you have ever been burglarized, you know how the victim felt. It is no minor event. Somebody has been in your house. Many people can't even live in their houses after an intrusion and violation like that. Now, why didn't the citizen say those four things? Why did he resort to every cliché he'd ever heard about what cops are doing when they're not on the scene? Because he was upset. He was frustrated. He was going to take it out on somebody. Now, how would the Michael Jordan of communication have responded? Someone who understood that the man had not meant what he said and knew where the real meaning lay would have used a sort of insertion and gone on from there. Something like, "Sir, listen to me. Whoa, I appreciate that. You're right, it's a jungle out there, or I would have been here sooner. But I'm here now, sir, and here is what I need to do. I need to see where those people got in the house and where they got out. And you need to conduct me on that tour and assist me in that investigation. While you're doing that, sir, I want you to be thinking very carefully about what is missing. Do you have pictures, serial numbers, markings on the stuff stolen? Because when we're done, I'm going to sit down with you and do a police report." This doesn't have to be meaningless paperwork. With a good report and lots of specifics, our department is often able to return 35% to 40% of stolen property over time, some of it in reusable condition. I'd like to think maybe that could happen for you. Before I leave, let me tell you another thing, sir. You rightly pointed out how busy I am, but I'm never too busy that I can't take a minute or two to walk around your house before leaving and point out some ways that you can safeguard it. I'm an expert in that area. May I come in?" I have to believe that would get a cop into just about any house in America. The citizen may still be smoking and sputtering, but the cop's job is getting done. The deputy should have two goals. First, he needs to get in and get out quickly and professionally. The computer screen in his squad car is full of calls waiting for action. Second, and just as important, the deputy needs to leave the citizen feeling better about the deputy than he ever thought he would when he first opened that door. The caller should know and be able to say, "That officer cared." The hostage situation. A man holding hostages once told me, "I want $1 million and an airplane." I said, "So do I." And I laughed. Humor, carefully used, can be a deflector, an identifying factor, a way to forge a bond and work with a dangerous personality. I went on, "Sir, we both like those things, wouldn't we? But let me tell you something I think you already know. That's not going to happen. The people surrounding the house, sir, they don't like you. They're the SWAT team, and they want to kill you. To be frank with you, that's not the police chief and command officers on the roofs over there. Those happen to be Vietnam veterans, and their only job is to come in here and take you out. Now look, I work for these people, and they don't even like me. Let's you and I work together and see if we can't come up with something that will put something in your pocket. Let's see what we can do about your drinking coffee tomorrow night and having your lady over for dinner. Those things I might be able to help you do. As it stands now, they're not going to let you do that. So give me something I can take back to them, and I'll see what I can do about getting you out of here alive and not in such deep trouble." He worked with me because I hadn't reacted to his words. I calmed him by telling him the truth. He wasn't going to get $1 million in an airplane any more than I was. But that didn't mean I couldn't address his needs. Hostage takers, just like children, express their demands and desires. We are not in the business of meeting those. Whether in our roles as cops or parents, we're in the business not of satisfying demands, but of meeting needs. If you gave your children everything they wanted, you'd turn them into mean, nasty little yuppies. You'd be working 2 and 3 jobs, and you'd grow old quick and die. Never react to what people say. React to what they mean. Just remember, people hardly ever say what they mean. Chapter 15. The third great communication art, mediation. In 1972, an interesting experiment was done by a school of communication in the East. They took a toddler, barely verbal, to a safe spot near a busy intersection and told him to watch the cars. He was fascinated by the motion of the traffic, and for as long as it held his attention, they let him watch. Then he was asked, "What did you see?" The little boy said, naively but accurately, "Sometimes cars go this way, and sometimes they go that way. They stop here, they go there." The little boy was told, "That's good. Now look up there." Without hearing any more explanation, the boy noticed the traffic light and soon began to see it change colors. Within 20 minutes, he was able to recognize order out of what had appeared disorder and make sense of what had appeared nonsense. He said, "Red, stop, green, go, yellow, I don't know." The point of that story, for my purposes, is that the person who pointed out the traffic light was a mediator. The great service of the mediator, whether it's a psychologist helping you and your spouse live in harmony, or a police officer working with somebody who refuses to get out of a car, is to help people see something new. Mediators do this by fulfilling one of the definitions of the Latin word medius, one who goes between. Effective mediators go between and across your experience, enabling you to see something in a new way. In short, they educate, making sense out of things by putting them into perspective. The Mountain Man in the Alley. It had never struck me in my 35 years prior to becoming a police officer that mediation was one of the great communication arts. But soon my training sergeant, Bruce Fair, began to teach me without knowing it. First, there was his ability to separate and suture warring couples. He would get them apart, calm them, and bring them back together, usually without an arrest or a bunch of paperwork. Then, of course, came the night he mediated a domestic dispute by reading the paper and asking to use the phone of an arguing couple. See Chapter 1. After my training period with Bruce, I had been out on my own for about 2 months when I got a call that a man had broken up some tables in a bar and had fled southbound into my beat. The man was described as about 6 feet 7 inches and almost 300 pounds, white, no shirt, sweating profusely, and known to be violent. Just what I needed on a one-officer beat. Sure enough, about 20 minutes later, I was sharking, cruising slowly back and forth, behind some taverns, when I spotted the guy in an alley with only one outlet, past me. I immediately radioed for help. I said, "I've got a man here as big as a house." A civilian can roll up the windows, lock the doors, and drive off as if he's seen nothing. As a cop, I knew I had to deal with the man. I stepped out of the car maybe 40 feet from him, planning to use words to stall him until my backups arrived. I'd never had a course in tactical communication. The man was holding a broken, jagged whiskey bottle by its neck, and he began to move toward me. I took a deep breath and worked at not sounding as scared as I was. I said, "Sir, I understand you broke up some tables and left a bar without paying. The bartender's pressing charges. Disorderly conduct, destruction of private property, theft of services. Put the bottle down, sir, and come with me. You're under arrest." Saying so doesn't make it so. The man mountain looked me up and down and said, "You ain't big enough to take me down. Look at you, you're just a little punk." Meanwhile, he was slowly, drunkenly shuffling toward me. Frankly, I thought he had a pretty good point, so I drew my stick and backed away a bit. Right then, without my realizing it until several years later, verbal judo was conceived. I said, "What are you going to do, sir? Cut me with that bottle? Listen, you're a great big guy. You can beat me up no problem. Look at this face. It's been hurt before. But let me tell you something. All I'm trying to arrest you for is disorderly conduct. That's just a misdemeanor. You'll be in jail overnight, and then you're out. Cost you maybe $30 if you're guilty. Then you're home. Taking me down is not such a hot idea. You hear those sirens? They're coming for you, sir. Men with big sticks and dogs, people who like to fight. You may hurt some of them, but bottom line, you're going to jail. Then you'll be looking at a felony. That's more like 90 days and hundreds of dollars in fines." He was still coming, and I was still talking. "Do you have a job?"
"Yeah."
"Well, you won't when you get out. What about a woman? Have you got yourself a lady at home?"
"Yeah."
Fortunately, I knew enough to say she might be there when he got out. If I had outright predicted she would abandon him while he was in jail, he would have wanted to fight me on that basis alone. "Listen," I said, "you can do what you want, but let me tell you that that bottle is constituting, as you hold it, a felony. Look, the bartender's charge is a misdemeanor. I'm looking for a misdemeanor, and you're trying to turn it into a felony. Why don't you give me a break and I'll cut you some slack? Let's say I didn't see the bottle. You drop it and come with me, and all we've got is a misdemeanor." To my amazement, he looked at the bottle as if seeing it for the first time and tossed it aside. He stopped moving, so I said, "Turn around." And by gosh, he did. I said, "Put your hands behind you." And he did that too. I cuffed him up, put him in the car, and headed to the jail. As I pulled out of the alley, 2 backup patrol cars filled with officers and dogs and sticks pulled in with their lights flashing. Realizing I didn't need them, I felt a strange new sense of power I'd never felt before. I was safe, my uniform wasn't ripped, which I would have had to pay for, my face was not bleeding, the other cars could go back into service for the community, and I would be back on patrol in 10 minutes. I thought, boy, that's power. Later, as I debriefed with Bruce Fair, I got a handle on what had gone right in a situation that could have gone all wrong. Here was a man under the influence of liquor, rage, fear, and pride. If I had confronted him, as I had been trained to do, I would have been in for serious violence. Instead, I had redirected his behavior by cutting across his experience, mediating, and giving him a fresh personal view of the situation from his own perspective. In essence, making it up as I went along, I used 5 different pieces of bait to hook him. I got him to think of the value of his time, one night in jail versus several weeks, his money, $30 versus hundreds, his job, working versus unemployment, his record, misdemeanor versus felony, and his woman, might be there versus might not. You'll notice that the essence of mediation lies in what I call the personal appeal. See chapter 21 for a complete discussion of the four basic appeals, which is the ability to reach people by putting what you want them to do in terms of what they have to gain or lose. If your opponent or customer has something to gain or lose, you have something you can use. Simply put, the art of mediation is the ability to skillfully present options, which takes us right back to step 3 of the 5-step hard style. See chapter 12. 3-in-1. All three of what I call the great communication arts were at work in that alley that night, even though I was a beginner feeling my way along. I wouldn't have had to represent the bartender in his complaint, but that seemed necessary to gain voluntary compliance. I chose not to insult the man or challenge him, because then I would have forced him to fight, the last thing I wanted to do. I've clarified that empathy underlies all these arts, and I was certainly trying to empathize that night. He and I had to work together if I wanted to keep working at all. So I had to think with him and, because he was under so many influences, I had to think for him too. Where's he coming from? What's he got to gain? What's he got to lose? What can I use? I had to think like him long enough to find the terms of my appeal. I had to remove my ego to keep from saying something stupid like, "You're not as tough as you think. I've got some black belts. I can hurt you too. Come on, try it." That would have been counterproductive, of course, because any time a professional manifests his personal face, he forces conflict. The art of translation was also clearly present that night. I sent my message, "Cooperate because it's best for you," but I was using his language, time, money, job, record, and girlfriend. The people you deal with may have other kinds of things to lose, like reputation, standing in the community or business, freedom of movement, financial options, family relationships. It's your job as professional communicator, or even an amateur verbal judo practitioner, to anticipate these and empathize. When you put things into context for the person, you're translating. When I helped the mountain man see which of his options were in his best interest, I was cutting across his experience as a service to him. That was mediation, getting him to see his experience in a way that would alter his behavior. Admittedly, my experience was from a police perspective. But isn't what I did also what we do when we deal with our children, where they're trying to keep them off drugs, get them to come in early, get them to take out the trash, or get them to study? We need to sound as if we care, keep our egos out of it, find the right words to reach them, and present options that will have a powerful influence. If you start mastering the three great arts of communication, backed by the 5-step hard style, you'll be able to interact professionally with anyone anywhere, under any circumstance. Chapter 16. What makes this all so difficult? One of my goals is to raise your expectations of yourself so you can become better tomorrow. You can learn to take more verbal abuse with greater style if you begin to see yourself as a professional who treats people with dignity and respect. You can become a verbal judo expert, someone who can not only represent and translate, but who can also mediate. What makes communication so difficult is another of my undeniable, inarguable street survival truths. When two people are talking, 6 different identities are involved. Each person's real self, each person as he is seen by himself, and finally, each person as seen by the other, doubled. The way the other person sees himself is monumental for you to understand. I've never had anyone say, "I'm an idiot, I'm off the wall, I'm a jackass, I'm stupid, illiterate, and dumb, but here's what I think." People don't go around thinking they're irrational, especially when they truly are. So never put a person down. Focus on the goal of gaining voluntary compliance, and always allow a person to save face. We know the least about our real selves. That's why we must deal with how we see ourselves. Our real selves may consist of where we come from, our beliefs and values, and the way we're raised. But ourselves as we see them will be bogus unless we make an effort to really be honest and introspective. If we don't, we will always have areas that can be exploited and can make us less effective than we could be. The way we are seen by others is vital, because we have a lot to say about determining that. If you consider yourself a professional, you will exude professionalism. One of the reasons I avoid bad-mouthing and humiliating people is that I don't like myself when I do it. It's no way for a professional to act. When dealing with somebody in a business or a law enforcement situation, you may be thinking, I'm handling this well. I'm firm, fair, and professional. But if the other person sees you as pushy and aggressive, as ineffective, biased, and intemperate, where does the truth lie? Unfortunately, it lies with how you're seen and not with how you see yourself. Even if you are right, I can prove it. Say I'm talking to you about a problem, and I think I'm handling you well. You do not think so. So what feedback are you going to give me? You're going to react based on how you see it, not on how I see it, and then I will have no choice. I can deal only with how you see it, even if I'm right. Otherwise, you might hit me upside the head. I'd be surprised, and you could flee, all because I was concentrating on my view of the encounter rather than yours. What if that happens in the business world? You get a letter of complaint. Someone says you're ineffective. Someone complains to the manager, and you're surprised. If you've ever been surprised by a complaint about your performance, you need some survival skill. Effective communication begins and ends with your ability to see yourself as you are seen. You desperately need the ability to read an audience and to sense from their voice and body language whether you're coming across the way you want to, so you can adjust. So the most important of the six selves involved in any two-person encounter is you as seen by the other. You need to develop increasingly sensitive radar to know how you're coming across while you're performing. Elements of communication. From the receiver's point of view, there are three elements of communication from which he will take his cues. The truth, which lies in the content element, carries a weight of only 7 to 10% of your total impact. Your very message, which you may see as the most important part of the process, is the least considered factor. Your voice carries a weight of 33 to 40%, and what I call your ONVs, other nonverbals, make up 50 to 60% of your impact. On the phone, where your ONVs can't come into play, content remains at 7 to 10% of your impact, while voice makes up the rest. Think about that. The goods, the truth, the point in these encounters, is almost irrelevant compared to your voice and body language, ONVs. The facts don't speak for themselves in court, in an arrest situation, in your office, or at home. People aren't buying what you say. They're concentrating on how you're saying it. In spite of that, you still have to be right, because should you be wrong about a single detail, you lose credibility. Lose credibility, and you lose belief. When people stop believing in you, you lose power and influence. Your history. Baby, it's you. If voice is so important, what do I mean by it? No guesswork here. Voice is your verbal personality as heard by the other. Remember the first time you heard your voice on a tape recorder? Like most of us, you probably said, "Hey, that doesn't sound like me. That's not me, is it?" Bad news. That's you, baby. That's you with the monotone voice, the gravelly voice, the condescending voice, the unpleasant voice. If our voices are as powerful as research shows, we'd better know as much as we can about them and how to improve them. There are four elements to voice. The first, tone, is the most deadly four-letter word I know. Tone of voice has caused more violence, more divorce, more lost court cases, more lost business, and more brawls than anything else I can think of. Why is tone so powerful? Because it conveys your real attitude toward people. To a customer, your words may be, "Yes, sir, I'm doing everything I can to help you." But if you have a negative, condescending tone of voice to go with them, do you know what the customer hears? In his mind, he tacks something onto the end of that sentence that has come through so loud and clear that he believes you said it. He hears, "I'm doing everything I can to help you, you idiot." If you've ever been puzzled by a complaint where somebody claimed you called him a name you had not, in fact, called him, this is why. He heard the name implied by your tone, and he heard it so clearly, he'll swear you said it. The only way to be careful enough with your voice to keep its tone from giving away your true feelings is to be sure there's harmony between the role you're playing and the voice you're using. I'm convinced that if there is any conflict between your role and your voice, people will always believe your voice. That means you must harmonize the two. And that, unfortunately, means that there are times when your voice must lie. I'm not talking about speaking an untruth. I'm talking about camouflaging a tone that would otherwise reveal your true feelings. You're a cop, and a lady asks you for directions to the convention hall. You snap, "Ma'am, you're standing right in front of it." What does she hear in her mind at the end of that sentence? "You fool." Now you know she didn't miss that tone. If she's a nice person, she just takes that insult and goes away, feeling bad. She'll say, "Thank you," and walk off thinking, "Gee, I thought they were supposed to help me." If she's a difficult person, she'll say, "Hey, thanks a lot, officer. Really appreciate that. Let me tell you something. I've had it with you people." Now she's in your face, and she wants your badge number. You're in deep trouble. If she's a wimp, you're even worse off. She takes the insult and says, "Thank you." But while she's at the convention, she's sitting on that insult, and it is inflating her with righteous adrenaline. She'll be thinking, "I should have said something. This is outrageous. I don't have to put up with this." This woman who went in at 80 pounds is now 400 pounds of adrenaline. She doesn't go to the party she was invited to. She goes home. She reaches for her phone or for her stationery, and you have yourself a complaint. Nice going. You did your job. You gave her the correct information. But your tone undercut your work. A role is a role is a role. Think how many roles we play in a given day. As a police officer, I played enforcer, good guy, bad guy, report writer, information dispenser, tourist guide, investigator, employer, supervisor, and so on. Regardless of your occupation, at different times during the day, you're probably playing mediator, translator, salesperson, customer service rep, complaint department chief, and so on. How would you, nearly an expert at verbal judo by now, have handled the lady asking you for directions to the convention center, the one she was standing in front of at the time? First, you're a chameleon, so you put on the appropriate face. She may be a dingbat, but she's not a speeder, not a criminal. She may be a nuisance, but she's a citizen, a constituent. So you smile, and you say, "Ma'am, you're in luck. Turn around, and you're there. As you go through the main entrance, take an immediate right and head to Gate B. That'll get you inside the quickest, okay? You have yourself a nice evening now, and thanks for stopping by." Now, if in reality you're a difficult person and a cynic, and you just have to make fun of her, wait till she turns away, hopefully with a smile and a thank you, and you can say to your partner, "Idiot." Just don't say it to her. Three other elements. Besides tone, your voice has three other elements: pace, pitch, and modulation. Pace, of course, is your speed. Pitch is how high or low or how loud and soft you speak. And modulation is your rhythm and inflection. If you want to calm somebody, modulate your voice as you assure them, "Listen, it's going to be all right." That's a whole lot different than, "Listen, I'm doing everything I can, so calm down." Cops also listen to pace and pitch to tell them whether people are getting more upset or coming to a decision that may not be good. If someone's voice picks up speed, watch out. He's getting excited and something may happen. If the voice slows down, he's thinking, which may be positive or negative. So be careful. If cops can tell that much by someone else's voice characteristics, imagine what others can tell from yours. Correct and appropriate tone, pace, pitch, and modulation can help you harmonize your voice with your role, and you will be successful communicating with people. Proximics. Proximics is a fancy word for proximity, or the way you stand around and carry yourself in your space. If 50 to 60% of your power and effectiveness in face-to-face encounters has to do with your ONVs, it only makes sense to work on your facial expressions, how you use your hands, and how you carry yourself. Your ONVs must harmonize with your voice. If your voice is calming, your demeanor has to be calming. Otherwise, people will not believe what you're saying. Remember, 93% of your success with people has to do with your delivery, and only the slightest percent has to do with what you say. A mediocre idea brilliantly presented often gains acceptance, whereas a brilliant idea badly presented often dies in birth. Your success with your children, your spouse, your employees, and the public hinges on how you come across. Think of yourself as the person who can make or break your audience. Your power to persuade, to combine and harmonize your voice with your other nonverbals, can transmit the message, "I'm here to serve you," because you convince your hearer that you care about what you're saying. Lights, camera, acting. The presentation of self is terribly important. If I had my way, I'd send everyone to acting school before having him or her deal with the public and perform 8 to 10 hours a day. But that's not feasible, so stay with me. Pick up on the principles and tactics of verbal judo, and you will find yourself more effective almost overnight. Chapter 17. Reading, Writing, and Rhetoric. To be a good persuader, you have to learn to read your opponent and the situation. Much like my old Indian mentor taught me to read a trail when I was 6 or 7 years old, I would like to teach you to read people and size up a verbal encounter. Because my doctorate is in English literature, a classical discipline, I feel the need to put things in rhetorical perspective. But don't feel intimidated. I'm also an earthy guy. Highfalutin as it may sound, rhetorical perspective is easily defined and helps put handles on the subject of this chapter. Rhetoric is an interesting word often used in the modern idiom to mean a bunch of words and no substance, such as, "That's just rhetoric." But the word has classical roots. Used by Aristotle, it was a word of dignity. It meant the art of verbal appeal or verbal persuasion. To me, rhetoric is the art of finding the right means and the right words to generate voluntary compliance. Rhetoric is verbal judo. The third R. Rhetoric was actually a subject taught in the American public school system up until about 1940 or so, and I, for one, wouldn't mind seeing it return to the classroom. Even if the concept is foreign to you, open your mind to it. I want to give you a rhetorical perspective on communication, persuasion, and generating voluntary compliance. I have developed an acronym, PAVPO, which I agree is kind of an ugly-sounding one, but which is also very serviceable. If you can lock it into your mind, it will help you memorize the 5 components of what I call the rhetorical perspective of verbal judo, some of which I have already discussed. Perspective, audience, voice, purpose, organization. If you can develop and use a rhetorical perspective in your daily life, you'll be far more skillful and effective as a communicator. Perspective. Perspective is simply the way you see things, your point of view, based on your knowledge, your understanding of the situation, your background, and your experience. You have to know what you're talking about to either a group or an individual. That means you have mastered your policies, your procedures, your products, what you can and cannot do. Too many people believe that preparing what they want to say is the end-all of effective communication. As important as that is, disregarding the other areas is an error, as I will show you. But first, let me address this issue of your own point of view. The more thoroughly you know what you know, the more powerfully you will present it. You will have an aura of certainty that comes only with preparation. There is no substitute for knowing what you want to say and having the data to back it up. For example, if I go before the city council to appeal for more money for my budget area, I will spend what time is necessary gathering my data and creating charts that compare my department with others. My evidence and arguments will all be marshaled. I will be prepared to control my emotions and biases and to plead my case from a position of strength. My perspective, based on my expertise, will come through because I know what I'm talking about and I'm under control. Audience. Many people, after their preparation, just go out before an audience and begin to speak, but that's a crucial blunder. You must spend equal time considering your audience, analyzing to whom you will be speaking. Who are these people on the city council, for example? If there are 8 people on the council, I must study all 8 individually. What are their values, their belief systems? How do they think? Who are their constituents? What will their objections likely be? I have to think carefully from their point of view. Once again, that powerful word empathy comes into play. I want to think like the others, put myself into their shoes, anticipate their reactions based on my knowledge of the positions from which they will be listening. Depending on my reading of these people, I may open differently. For example, if I know that they're highly analytical people, or that at least several are antagonistic, I will probably open with a series of examples of data comparison, factually showing that my need for money is real. If I have determined that there is no one that highly analytical in the audience, I might try another approach altogether. If it's kind of a good old boy city council, I might start out being much more chatty and informal. If they are self-righteous and see me as an underling who should be deferential, I'll be that, and maybe a little self-effacing with some self-deprecating humor. When they're impressed and know that I know my place, I will earnestly prove my need for funds and hope for the best. Whether you're speaking to a room full of citizens, a city council of eight, or just one disgruntled customer, you are on stage. You are playing a role before others, and you should be aware of the dynamics of each situation. For example, when I teach, I often suddenly pull a camera out of my bag and point it at the students. Immediately, the room changes. Everything becomes still and silent, and then there's some nervous giggling, people looking down, others warily looking at that camera, wondering what I'm doing with it. Think of yourself as that camera. As you enter a scene, it changes. You can make two assumptions right off the bat. First, people will always see differently than you. I don't care whether you've been married 2 or 20 years. Your spouse does not think the way you do. The moment you begin to believe that he or she does, you're headed for problems. Never assume people are going to agree with you 100%. Second, as you enter, you're very much like an actor appearing on stage. The audience quiets, and they watch. When I walked into a bar as a police officer, the whole place hushed. People whispered, "Cops," or "The police are here." People's behavior changed. They tried to surreptitiously hide contraband and say, "Oh, yes, evening, officer. Oh, yes, evening." Even if they were clearly up to no good, they were doing their best to appear otherwise. Not only did they change as I entered the bar, but they also watched me. Again, it was as if I had walked on stage. They watched as I performed. You must think of yourself as a performer, whether before your children, your spouse, or your constituency, citizens, customers, whomever. If you can see yourself as someone who is there to make changes as you act, you will understand a most interesting point, first made by Aristotle, that audiences are made, not found. If an actor does a poor job, and the audience says he's terrible, it makes no difference that the actor thinks he did a brilliant job. How he sees himself, remember, is not as important as how he's seen. If an audience thinks you're boring, you are. If an audience thinks you don't know what you're talking about, you don't. You've got a problem. You fail to perform in such a way as to get their attention. More than likely, you fail to analyze in advance who those people really are, what they might think, what they might anticipate, what their objections might be. If you had, then as you entered the scene, your walk and your voice would have appropriately matched their needs. Voice. See Chapter 16. Purpose. Purpose is, of course, your bottom line, the result you must professionally achieve. If you do everything else right and don't achieve your purpose, obviously, you failed. You'd be surprised at the number of people who go into a presentation or an argument concerned only with preparing or knowing their audience or using their voice properly and being satisfied that they have done all these things, only to realize later that they did not achieve their purpose. If all you care about is the means and not the end, you'll be thrilled if you perform well. As for me, I'm into results. I want to see the purpose achieved, even if everything else doesn't go perfectly. If, however, you have a handle on perspective, audience, and voice, your purpose will likely be fulfilled. One way to ensure that you'll be effective is to concentrate on the last letter in my homely, but hopefully effective, acronym. Organization. Organization is simply how you want the encounter to unfold from beginning to middle to end. The responsibility for ordering the event is yours, and you will, of course, organize it based on your reading of the situation. Nowhere did I learn more clearly the importance of this component than on the streets as a cop. Let me use another police example, because I believe it is easy to transfer the principles to your situation. Police work represents the essence of verbal judo and stark clarity. In other words, if it doesn't work on the street, you can't use it at home or at the office. Take the average, everyday, non-felony car stop. At one time or another, you have likely been stopped by the police, so you can identify with this and compare it with your experience. The average police officer not trained in tactical communication tends to approach a car and immediately snap, "Let me see your driver's license." To which the driver often responds, "Why? What have I done? Why are you stopping me?" Notice that all the initial verbal conflict arises from the fact that the officer asked for the driver's license first. What if he asked for it later, anticipated the questions, and answered them before they were asked? One of my pet peeves is the officer who studies the license and then asks, "Do you know why I stopped you? What is that, a quiz?" Most fully functioning adults know a setup when they see one. Who's going to give him what he needs to write a ticket? The obvious answer, even if you have an idea what you might have done, is, "No, why did you stop me?" What does the cop expect? Surely not an answer like, "Yes, officer, I know why you stopped me. I was speeding, driving recklessly, ignoring stop signs, and drinking in the car." However, I teach across the country what I call a 9-step car stop. It has a far different order from the way most officers are trained. It goes like this. 1. Greeting. "Good evening, sir/ma'am. I say it with sincerity and a smile. More than likely, I'm dealing with a normal citizen, not a dangerous criminal. Pleasantly, I break the ice. 2. Identification of yourself and department. "I'm Officer Thompson of the hometown police department." That should make me sound as if I know what I'm doing. I'm establishing command presence, clarity, and an unafraid approach. I've offered my title, officer, my name, and my authority, the name of my department. We know from research that when you give your name, you personalize the encounter to the point where you can expect less verbal abuse. Once I have given my name, it becomes harder for the citizen to start calling me names and treating me like some abstract, uniformed, unknown authority person. Names have a way of calming people. Too often we use numbers and titles rather than names. In a store, doesn't it help if the clerk at the counter introduces himself and says, "Hi, I'm Bill. How can I help you?" 3. Reason for the stop. "The reason I stopped you is that I did pace you over the last 4 blocks at 45 miles per hour in a 20 zone. Notice I've given the reason right up front, even before asking for the license. Then I move immediately into the next step. 4. Justification. "Is there some reason for such excessive speed this evening?" Normally the answer is dead silence, because it's hard to say anything without convicting yourself. But if you're bleeding and taking yourself to the hospital, or your wife is having a baby in the car, there just might be justification for exceeding the speed limit. In such a case, the officer will escort you to your destination as quickly as is safe. When, however, there is no answer to the justification question, I can go right on to the next step. 5. Request license, papers, and cooperation. "May I see your driver's license?" By now, the encounter, rather than starting as usual with this threatening step, sounds more like, "Good evening, sir/ma'am. I'm Officer Thompson of the hometown police department. The reason I stopped you is that I did pace you over the last 4 blocks at 45 miles per hour in a 20 zone. Is there some reason for such excessive speed this evening? If not, I will need to see your driver's license." Not only does that sound polite, but notice that also there is a command presence. I sound knowledgeable. I sound clear. I sound professional. Also, there's no personal challenge or a snapping at the citizen. Perhaps most important, look what the driver can no longer say. "Why are you stopping me?" I've told him. "Who do you think you are?" I've even told him that, and it's not who I think I am. I'm acting under the authority of the city. By anticipating certain kinds of abuse and questions, I have ordered my presentation to deflect them. I have taken those weapons away from my opponent and made him less of an opponent and more of an ally. I basically have sounded professional without having angered the citizen. As kind and professional as that approach is, It is also very forceful, and these 5 steps will usually persuade the person to produce a driver's license. 6. Clarification. If there's anything more I need to know, is this your current address? Is there anything I can help you with? I ask it now. 7. Decision. There are only 3 things a police officer can do. He can warn you and let you go, cite you with a ticket, or move to the optional next step. 8. Search and seize. This step is necessary only if the officer sees contraband or discovers that your car is stolen, you're wanted for some other offense, or you create a disturbance by physically resisting. That, of course, is rare. 9. Close. My goal here is to effectively and appropriately close the encounter so you feel better about it than you did at first. If I issue you a ticket, I will say, "Thank you for your cooperation. Do drive carefully." If I have given you a warning, I will say, "Have a nice day." Notice that I don't say, "Have a nice day" if I've given you a ticket, because I just cost you money and would thus sound sarcastic. Look at the advantages of the 9-step car stop and apply them to your typical confrontations. It's polite. It normally generates voluntary compliance. Its structure creates presence for you and deflects verbal abuse. If this approach fails and abuse is still coming your way, you can immediately switch to step 2, setting context, of the 5-step hard style outlined in chapter 12. If that doesn't work, move to confirmation. Is there anything I can say or do to get you to cooperate? If the answer is no, you must take action. I hope it never gets to that point for you, unless you are in law enforcement and have all the resources you need to coerce compliance. This structured, professional approach should keep you safe and sounding good, even when you may be having a bad day. The professional communicator can't let bad days get to him. Under pressure, the pro just gets better. That 9th step, the appropriate close, should be memorized to the point where it's second nature and can be enacted even when you don't like the person you're dealing with. The 9th step keeps you safe because you sound professional. It allows you to ignore your negative inner voice, which would have you give that speech you would live to regret. But I'm a civilian. Fair enough. You don't have at your disposal the uniform, the law, the tactics, the weapons of a cop. Your problem is not a speeder or a dangerous lawbreaker. Maybe you're in a business, dealing with a complaining customer who is clearly overreacting and out of control. First, make it your goal, your business, to win the person over. No matter what is said, you're going to deflect the abuse, not take it personally, remain professional, and keep your eyes on the purpose. You want what the customer wants, satisfaction and a happy result. Let nothing stand in the way of that. Can you see the transferable principles from PAVPO and even several from the 9-step car stop? You have perspective because you have mastered your policies, your procedures, your products, what you can and cannot do. You have that aura of certainty that comes only with preparation. Remember that there is no substitute for knowing what you want to say and having the data to back it up. You have an audience you may not have had time to study, but take whatever time you can to research them anyway. If you're on the phone with a disgruntled customer, try to bring the account up on your computer and stall for enough time to pull it from the file. Anything you can learn about the person or the account will help in how you deal with them. I hope we can straighten this out for you so that you can enjoy the product as much as you have the garden tractor. Is that still working out for you? Or if you see a previous return in the file, you might ask if the reimbursement arrived in due time and apologize for any delay. Clearly, your voice in such an encounter should be soothing and authoritative. You're as apologetic as necessary, as confident as you can be, and reassuring, insisting that the customer finally has the right person and that by the time you are finished, action will have been taken. Your purpose was determined as soon as you silently set your mind to satisfying this customer. Obviously, there is a limit to what you can do, and that limit is the integrity and well-being of your business. But when you know what kind of damage one unhappy customer can do to a company, that expands the horizon of possibilities. Your purpose is to turn a bad situation into a good one, an unhappy customer into a happy one. Many management experts will tell you that it is better to have a satisfactorily repaired relationship with a customer than a relationship that has never had a hitch. Such results are talked about among friends, and people take notice. Organization, you'll recall, is how you want the situation to unfold. That is in your hands. Don't let the customer dictate it. When a customer starts raising his voice or making accusations, that is the time to take charge. With your best